Hello, I'm Steve Wiggins, and this is podcast number 7 of the Sects and Violence in the Ancient World blog. Today's topic is going to be the devil. One of the surprising moments for my students in the introduction to the Hebrew Bible class is the revelation that the Hebrew Bible has no devil. I think it's an assumption by many people in our culture and in the wider world in general that the Bible is the source of our information about this unusual character that we come to know by a number of different titles, the devil, Satan, Mephistopheles, or any other number of titles. One of the reasons for this basic conundrum is that we have a very different perception in our world of what the divine world or the supernatural order looks like than they did in the ancient world. The Israelites were part of a culture that was monistic in its outlook. It was not dualistic. To put it in simpler terms, what that means is that the people of ancient Israel understood reality as being essentially one and not two main sources. So, in other words, there's a single God and not a God and anti-God concept and operation. We can see this clearly in the Bible itself, where there are passages that quote God as claiming to be responsible for both good and evil. This is one of the main consequences of a system that's developing towards monotheism. If you wish to have only one deity, there's always some difficulty in accounting for the source of evil. There's a way around that, of course, and that way turns into a character known as the devil, and we'll talk more about how that develops in just a few minutes. So one of the basic ideas that we find in the Hebrew Bible is that God is responsible for the world in its present form. Now, this is an early perception among the Israelites, and over time, of course, Israel came into contact with various other cultures through its being conquered by them or through relationships by trade or other aspects of communication in the ancient world. And when they came into contact with the religions of ancient Persia, one of which is Zoroastrianism, there were a number of facets of Zoroastrianism that came to have a profound impact on the Israelite way of looking at things. One of these was that Zoroastrianism was a dualistic system. They did believe in a universe that had both good and evil, represented by deities that were responsible for those respective realms. There was an ultimate good god, but there was also an ultimate bad god. They were not entirely equal in power or authority, but they were similar, and so there was a very real struggle between good and evil. One of the main facets of Zoroastrianism in the ancient world was to try to prepare its followers for being able to fight on the side of good so that good ultimately would win over evil. This kind of dualism was foreign to the Israelites at first. They simply did not have anything in their experience to compare to that. So we eventually will find the dualism creeping its way into the Bible in the form of a character known as the Satan. When this character appears in the Hebrew Bible, and it's only in a couple of passages, he is not called the devil. There is no concept of the devil in the Hebrew Bible. He is called the Satan, always with a definite article. And the reason for this is that he is not a character with a personal name, Satan. That's a much later development. The Satan is his title. And that title means the accuser. That's his job. The Satan was part of the wider Persian world, part of the Divine Council. And to get the idea of the Divine Council down, you have to understand that also the Hebrew Bible shares in this perception as well, that the gods in the ancient world met together to discuss affairs on the earth. That was part of their job as gods. So they got together, we don't know how often, but they got together and discussed the affairs of human beings. And as they got together, of course, they had various deities associated with different regions or different nations, and different gods associated with different phenomena, that sort of thing, that would apparently meet together. In the book of Job, we have a description of this, where Yahweh is the God in charge of the people of Israel, of course, but in the book, he's simply the God in charge of the divine council. And one of the other characters who shows up is a character called the Satan. His title means the accuser, and his job is to go around the world accusing people who are guilty of various crimes, various sins. That's his job. And so the Satan is not portrayed as an evil character. He is simply doing his job when he goes about trying to find people who have committed some crime or sin, and he brings them to justice. So when Job is pointed out in the book of Job as being a perfect individual, we find that that is not something that the Satan does. It's actually something that Yahweh does. Yahweh is the first to raise the subject. He says, here's Job. He's perfect. Have you considered him? And of course, this gets the Satan all bothered, because you can't have really somebody who is ultimately perfect unless they are being protected by God, which is how the book plays out, of course, as it goes on. The other place that the Satan occurs, obviously, in the Hebrew Bible is in the book of Zechariah. Zechariah was a prophet who lived during the Restoration period. That is roughly the 6th century or so BCE. And during that time period, his main concern was the rebuilding of the temple. The temple in Jerusalem had been destroyed by the Babylonians, and Zechariah was a prophet who wanted to see the temple rebuilt. The book of Zechariah, however, was edited over a long period of time, and we can see that quite clearly towards the Restoration period, the Israelites had come into contact with Persians. The book of Zechariah was written during the Persian period, and one of the characters that appears in the book is this Satan character again. Again, his role is not as an evil person, but he is an accuser, and he stands to accuse the high priest, somebody by the name of Joshua at this point in time. And his accusations are not intended to be evil. They're simply, again, the Satan doing his job. So we see that the idea during the Restoration or Persian period in the Hebrew Bible, the idea of the Satan or the accuser caught on. Now, this is not an anti-God, an anti-Christ kind of figure, as comes out later in time. This is simply a character, a guy doing his job. That's all he really is. The true dualism hadn't set in yet, and Israelite religion was not yet dualistic. It was simply now admitting that there were other characters who might play a role in the divine realm. Now, the Satan is not alone as being a character in the divine realm or the divine council. Many of the earlier characters who appeared in the Hebrew Bible or in religions before the ancient Israelites came along simply became angelic characters when we get to the Hebrew Bible. So they're there, but they're no longer fully gods. They're more in the form of angels. And so they are recognized as being divine, yes, but not fully divine, not as divine as, say, Yahweh or the main gods. Now, this is actually where the Hebrew Bible pretty much leaves us off with the development of this character of the Satan. Of course, the latest book in the Hebrew Bible is the book of Daniel, and Daniel was written during the Hellenistic period, more specifically in the Seleucid period, when the Israelites, or the Jews at that point, were being persecuted by the Seleucid rulers to the point of having Judaism itself outlawed. And at this point in time, the metaphor that is used for this evil that is coming against the Israelites or the Jews, it is understood to be some sort of character of the angelic world who is coming close to a sort of devil character, but not quite. He's never called the devil, but he is simply the prince of Persia who fights against Michael, who is the supreme commander of Yahweh's army. And so we're still not quite at the realm of a devil. The first perception that we get, the first actual mention of a devil in the Hebrew Bible, or not in the Hebrew Bible, but in the biblical tradition, comes in the Gospels, where we have the story of the temptation of Jesus. And that story has, of course, Jesus and Satan sparring off, if you will, after the 40 days of temptation in the wilderness, when Jesus is feeling weak and is vulnerable, at least in the eyes of this potential arch enemy. And by that point in time, we've had a few centuries pass, and some ideas developed a little bit more fully than they were in the Hebrew Bible. At this point, we start getting a character who is clearly against God, somebody who is evil. His origins are also explained as being that of a fallen angel, so he is not a god or an anti-god. He is an angelic being who has fallen from grace and therefore leads to this kind of character of the angel who is against God. And of course, he's got minions on his side, others who fell with him. Interestingly enough, in the Hebrew Bible, and also in the New Testament, we don't really have a concept of an evil being living in hell. As a matter of fact, in the New Testament, the Satan character or the devil is never pictured as living in hell. That's a coalescence of ideas that occurs later on. Those ideas develop separately and over a longer period of time. Again, the Hebrew Bible has no concept of hell. It does not exist. When you die in the Hebrew Bible, you go to Sheol, the place of the dead. It's not necessarily a pleasant place, but it's where everybody goes when they die. The idea of hell develops again over time, and the first reference that we get to that idea in any kind of solid form, again, comes in the Gospels, where we have Jesus making reference to a place called Gehenna, a place where the fire burns perpetually. Gehenna was probably something like the trash heap outside of Jerusalem, where they kept the fires burning to burn up the rubbish. And that image of a place where the fire never goes out appeals as a kind of place of perpetual punishment. Even at that point, we don't have this character of the devil living in hell. That doesn't occur at that point. It's a much later idea. So these ideas develop over time. Now, where does the devil get his characteristics that we are so used to seeing him with in our society? We're used to seeing and recognizing the devil. I live in New Jersey, where the Jersey Devils have an iconic representation that we're all used to seeing of the devil with pointed horns, and he's red. He's got a goatee, and he's got the pointy tail and all of that. A number of these ideas actually did not develop until the Middle Ages. They may have ancient pedigrees, but they are not ancient ideas about what the devil looked like. We'll start with the concept of his semi-animal form, his zoomorphic form. That is to say that the devil is often portrayed with horns on his head and with goat's feet. It seems that this idea was one that was based on Greek mythology. People in the Middle Ages start making references or making images, drawing pictures of, or making paintings of the Satan, as portrayed with the characteristics of the Greek god Pan. Pan was a deity who was known as a dying god in the ancient world. He actually comes to a rather sad end, according to some of the myths. And so he's associated with the infernal regions, the underworld, if you will. And as such, he is a good candidate for associating with a being who, by the Middle Ages, the Satan, the devil, also associated with the underworld, or hell, as it is at this point. And so the two of them kind of coalesce as far as their images are concerned. But we'd really be not doing our homework if we stopped there, because the horns and the goat feet actually have a much older pedigree even than Pan. It's less widely recognized in today's world that Greek mythology frequently borrows from Semitic mythology. And it's becoming increasingly clear over time that the Greeks were aware of the people who lived further east and were quite enamored of their stories. And so many of the characters in Greek mythology borrow either features or even episodes from the stories that the Semitic peoples were telling in their myths. So where does the horn idea come in? Well, horns are a perpetual part of divinity in the ancient world. They represent gods. This goes all the way back to the Sumerians, the very earliest civilization that we know about. You can tell that a character is a god in Sumerian representation by the multiple horns that they have on their helmets. Horns represent strength, and strength is appropriate to a deity, to a god. That's what you expect to have horns on their head. And this idea travels through Mesopotamia, in which we find, again, the Assyrians and Babylonians representing gods as having horns, and into the West Semitic world, where people who lived in the Levant, the area of Ugarit, also represented their gods as having horns. The famous stela of Baal that was excavated from Ugarit shows him wearing horns. So horns were representative of divinity, and specifically divinity that is foreign, if you will, from an Israelite point of view. So when the Israelites get a hold of this idea and eventually become monotheistic, they develop the idea that horns are representation of a foreign god, therefore a bad god. And a bad god, well, once you start to get that idea, you're starting to get pretty close to the devil. The same thing could be said for goat's feet. Pan is presented as having the lower extremity of a goat quite often in the iconography. This probably goes back to the world of the Hebrew Bible, because we have characters there who are presented in goat form, who are somewhat suspect as far as their pedigree is concerned. Consider, for example, the Day of Atonement, narrated in Leviticus 16. Here we have a character called the scapegoat. The scapegoat is a sacrifice that is the sins of the community placed on its head, and it is led out of the camp so that it can take those sins away and take them into the wilderness. The Hebrew Bible says that the scapegoat is sent out for Azazel. Now, we know very little about Azazel, but we do know that this is probably considered to be a desert-dwelling demon of some sort. And as a desert-dwelling demon, we have the idea of a goat coming out to that demon and being slaughtered by it, and so some sort of association between goat and demon. And these ideas mix around for some time and eventually come out with the idea that demons quite often are portrayed with goat-like characteristics. Now, I'm not saying it goes directly back to Azazel, but it is interesting that Azazel becomes a later name for the devil in Christian tradition. So you've got that connection clearly attested later on in the development of the idea of the devil. So we've got horns and goat's feet. Now, we also have the question of the color of the Satan character. It's typically portrayed as red, and that's a rather strange concept and one that's harder to trace out historically. We don't know exactly when people first started portraying the devil as a red being. It stands to reason that one of the associations here could have been that as the devil came to live in hell, he's living in a very hot environment. And if you spend any time in a hot environment, you know that people tend to turn kind of reddish if they're out in the sun too much. At least some people do. And so when you see somebody with red skin, that associates them with heat. They've been in a hot place. And so it seems quite natural to present the devil as being red. The goatee probably, again, goes back to the goat from which it takes its name. So we've got the idea of a kind of goat-like beard. This mixing of animal and human characteristics is not at all unusual in the ancient world, but they coalesce into this character of the devil that we recognize today. Now, in all likelihood, if you had asked an early believer in the devil or an early Christian believer what they had thought about the portrayal or the characteristics of the devil, it might have been much more positive. The reason for that is that the devil in origin in Christian thought is a fallen angel. And angels were generally considered to be somewhat decent-looking. Now, there are some scary angels, clearly. Things like cherubim and even seraphim could be quite frightening, according to accounts that we have in the Bible, and they're not intended to be nice to look at. But angels, in general, look like people, as generally they are presented in the Bible. They are messengers. People are often mistaking angels for human beings. So we've got this sort of idea of an angel and angelic beings being somewhat decent to look at that would have led to this concept of perhaps a rather handsome-looking Satan. We all know the phrase handsome devil that is still used, even popularized in some sense in Elvis's song Devil in Disguise. So we know the ideas of these handsome-looking but evil kind of characters. And this is probably closer to the post-biblical perception of what the Satan looked like. The word for devil, diabolos, comes from Latin, and it also means accuser. And this shows us that what we have here is really the personification of guilt, if you will. So the ultimate origin of this character, who we think of today as being evil, is really a projection of human guilt onto the divine world. We all know how guilt affects us when we've done something wrong. We know we've done something wrong and you feel guilty about it. If we personify that guilt, we soon come up with a character that accuses us. And as we all know, if you start to distance a character who is somewhat unpleasing from you, it's very easy to literally demonize that character and make them into true and pure evil. That seems to be what happened with the concept of the devil. We don't know where the concept came from originally, but there were people who understood this as being a character who fought against God's intentions for the universe and therefore became the origin of evil for all the rest of the world as we know it.